It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Well, today it's the Chinese chef who makes great Chinese food without Chinese ingredients. Our guest award winner, Susanna Fu, shook up traditionalists with her Philadelphia restaurant. Her book is Susanna Fu, Fresh Inspiration. Well, the Sterns are proving that rules are meant to be broken. At the White River Fish Market in Tulsa, wine maverick Josh Wesson talks the new wave in winemaking, biodynamics. We meet the guy who, with a bike named Old Yellow and a big pot, became the soup peddler of Austin, Texas. And our refrigerator game is back. Stump the cook. Five things from your fridge. Can I turn them into a great dish? Our guest stump master, Christopher Kimball, will decide. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
We'll be right back.
Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. When I asked our guest today, Chinese chef Susanna Fu, which Chinese ingredient she always had on hand, she said, soy sauce. And I said, and? And she responded, soy sauce. This woman and her Philadelphia restaurant keep winning awards, yet she cooks Chinese like few others. Susanna's book is Susanna Fu, Fresh Inspiration, New Approaches to Chinese Cuisine. Wine expert Josh Wesson talks what you don't necessarily see on the label, but is happening in the vineyard, the new biodynamic wines. And in a one-of-a-kind neighborhood, a guy came up with a one-of-a-kind business. David Ansel started delivering soups on his bike, Old Yellow. He's now the famous soup peddler of Austin's Bolton Creek. And the refrigerator game is back. Stump the cook. And success or failure rests in the hands of our guest stump master, Christopher Kimball of America's Test Kitchen. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we've just come back from Oklahoma, and we have one of the most unlikely suggestions for you of a good place to eat in the middle of Oklahoma. You know, when you think of Oklahoma, you think of barbecue, terrific beefsteak,
right.
Maybe catfish. Yeah. Well, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there is a restaurant there that's been there since 1932 called the White River Fish Market. And it is a great place to go for seafood in the middle of Oklahoma.
Which breaks every stern rule of the road. I mean, we have spent the last gazillion years telling everybody, when you're in Oklahoma, don't eat seafood.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Here we are in Tulsa eating seafood, and it was quite delicious.
So is this like a real fish market, you know, the kind of place where you go in and say, I want that one? And
yeah, exactly. It's sort of semi-cafeteria style in that you walk up to a counter, and there in the glass case are all the fish that they have. And many people buy them to take home and cook. Mm-hmm. But you can just say, that looks good. Fry that for me. Or that looks good. I'd like that broiled.
Yeah, you can actually pick the piece and point at it or to it. And the thing that I adore about this place is the food comes with the best pepper-laced hush puppies.
Oh, yeah.
And pinto beans, wonderful non-gloppy coleslaw, spiced rice, which is kind of like
this
a Mexican rice, and gumbo. Oh, it's wonderful.
You know, hush puppies, I think, are so underrated.
Oh, I could live on hush puppies. And these are really good. They're large hush puppies. Every meal comes with two of these, and they're almost the size of a baseball.
I mean, I always wish I was a squirrel or a, what breed of animal is that? A marsupial? No, where they have pouches
that they can stuff things in.
Yeah,
yes,
like put nuts in for the winter. I always want to put hush puppies in my gels for the
Jane,
winter.
That's what airline carry-on bags are for, dear.
I know, and hush puppies are unfortunately one of those dishes that it's like onion rings. You have to eat them immediately.
They you want don't, them crisp.
You don't want them the next day.
So they've been doing this thing since 1932?
Since 1932. And one of the things we love about this place is that even though it doesn't fit the rules of road food, in some ways it does, in that it's a real kind of neighborhood, democratic sort of operation. Everyone eats there. Black people, white people, rich people, poor people.
Yeah, you see a lot of workmen on their lunch hours coming in with their workmen's outfits.
And bankers in pinstripes, and everyone stands in line. And it's a weird system, too, because you stand in line, you place your order, you pay for it, and then find a table, and then somehow, it's a huge place, somehow they find you at your table and bring you the correct order. How this happens, I don't know.
Without
you don't
asking
have a number.
Your name or
no,
number.
They just find you.
They probably said, you see those two weird people there who don't look like they're from Tulsa? Bring them the boiled shrimp.
The ones that ordered a triple order of hush puppies on the side.
Yes.
Right,
exactly.
And
that would be
the woman who's trying to stuff them into her cheeks for hibernation.
Okay, so I've eaten at the fish market. Now, what else is happening in Tulsa?
Well, you can listen to Bob Wills sing "Take Me Back to Tulsa" everywhere you go. We actually we bought a wonderful CD of Bob Wills tunes in Tulsa. The other thing about Tulsa, we actually happened upon this place in Tulsa because what we were doing was traveling along Old Route 66 through Oklahoma, much of which doesn't exist anymore, but parts do. You know, it's been replaced by Interstate 40. But nevertheless, when you travel down from Miami, Kansas, towards Texola, Oklahoma, you pass through Tulsa. And it's a real this place strikes me as a real taste of old Route 66. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kind of place you'd get off the road and it would be just a wonderful kind of place you'd mark in your book and you'd always eat there if you were passing through.
So we got to do seafood in Oklahoma. Okay, perfectly logical.
Hey, guys. Absolutely. The new rules of the road.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
We always wear a great big smile, never do look sour.
No.
Travel all over the country, playing by the hour. Take me back, Tulsa, I'm too young to marry. Take me back, Tulsa, I'm too young to marry.
Jane and Michael Stern's classic guide, Road Food, has been updated. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can find their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, we are heading into cooking season big time, and Thanksgiving's coming up. This is deer in the headlights time for an awful lot of people who don't normally cook. Well, we have a culinary triage program for you. We call it Turkey Confidential. It's a special live call-in on Thanksgiving morning, and I'm going to be doing it with my friend, Marketplace's Kai Rizdahl. Now, it's an hour of open lines for your calls. Anything goes. So be sure to check with your station to find out what time Turkey Confidential is going to air in your area. You know, it wasn't enough for Josh Wesson to win awards as a sommelier or to co-author a now cult book called Red Wine with Fish. No, Josh had to leave behind those bottles priced in three figures. He now dedicates himself to tracking down great sipping for modest money for his bestsellers wine shops and for us. Josh, it is good to have you back.
Oh, I always love being with you.
Josh, what's your take on biodynamic wines?
You know, it took me a while to figure out just exactly what biodynamic wine was because a lot of people, me included, think that it's the same or similar to organic wine.
Yeah, yeah.
But in fact, although they are complementary in a lot of ways, they're different animals, or in this case, different ways of treating wine, looking at wine, growing grapes, and ultimately biodynamic wines are really wines that come out of a philosophy from an Austrian guy named Rudolf Steiner, who's more famous for his schools, I think, than for his contribution to winemaking. But this guy came up with a foundation of modern biodynamic farming, and he wrote, I don't know, almost 100 years ago about the spiritual foundation for the renewal of agriculture. And biodynamic farming came out of all of his ideas about how to make the soil healthy. That's really what biodynamic farming is all about.
How does it actually work, though, when it comes to grapes?
Well, the key to biodynamic farming in the vineyard is to look at the vineyard as a living system. So it's self-sustaining, and it's part of the larger scheme of things, but it has to be holistic. It's like holistic medicine for a person, except in this case, the person is the vineyard. And you want to use as little intervention as possible to keep the vineyard healthy. And they do some pretty extreme things. I mean, biodynamic preparations can involve everything from cow manure fermented in a cow horn to yarrow root fermented in a stag's bladder scattered throughout the vineyard. But at the end of the day, all of these things are meant to make the soil healthy, because the belief of biodynamic farmers is that if the soil is healthy, the fruit will be healthy. And in the case of a person making wine, the wines will taste that much better for it.
So who's doing the biodynamic wines?
Well, you might think that, and by the way, I should say that the big difference between biodynamic farming and organic is that organic farmers and organic winemakers don't allow the use of sulfites, but biodynamic producers can use sulfites because it has nothing to do with the vineyard. That's something to do with winemaking and completely separate.
Okay.
But there are people all over the world doing this, and some of the most famous producers in the world have gone back to biodynamic farming because they think it actually improves their wine. Chapoutier in the Rhone, Robert Sinsky in the Napa Valley, Domaine Ostertag up in Alsace. There isn't a wine-producing region that doesn't have a superstar making great biodynamic wines. It's amazing how much this has caught on in the last 10 years.
What are some you think we should try?
Well, a lot of times one would think like organic wines are going to be more expensive because it's a more expensive process. But with biodynamic farming, it's not necessarily true that the wines are more expensive. And I found a handful of wines that are actually downright low in price. One of them is made by Chef Poudier, who's one of the most famous producers in the Rhone. And he makes something called the Belarouche Rouge, which is his Côte de Rhône. Entry-level Côte de Rhône, and it sells for about $10, and it's just a delicious classic Côte de Rhône made with biodynamic farming applied to it. If you go up to Champagne, there's a producer named Fleury who makes a wonderful Brut Champagne for about $35, which will hold its own with any Brut Champagne in the world, just stunning stuff, called Carte Rouge. And it's just an exquisite biodynamic. It also happens to be a little grower, so it's produced in small quantities. It's something that can give you bragging rights if you like that kind of thing.
I love that. I love that. Boutique vineyard, right?
Of course. And if you go right to California, Robert Sinsky has embraced this, as has Ciago. And I just had the other day a Sauvignon Blanc from Ciago, from Kathleen's Vineyard, and that's Ciago. And it was about $16, and it was a knockout of a wine. Fabulous. Again, you know, absolutely able to hold its own with any Sauvignon Blanc at that price coming out of California.
So biodynamic may not be on the label, but if you kind of know what to look for, you can find them, and they're pretty easy to find.
Yeah. You know, it's not regulated by any government, either in Europe or in the United States. It's just something that one would put on the label if one wanted to. And I think that probably there will be some regulation at some point. But right now, it's something to look for if you're into holistic medicine, holistic living, and holistic wine.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Rehabilitated sommelier Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his biodynamic wine picks, you know where. The website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, each week we send you a quick weeknight supper recipe and shopping and technique tips. And best of all, Weeknight Kitchen's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Susanna Fu's new Chinese cooking, the soup peddler of Austin, Texas, and the return of Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all-in-one where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. When Chef Susanna Fu opened her Philadelphia restaurant, Susanna Fu Chinese Cuisine, a lot of traditionalists' eyebrows were raised. Her food wasn't like other Chinese places. Susanna was loosening and rewriting the rules in her own unique way. And in the process, she racked up awards for her eatery and her first book. Well, now she's freed up even more with her second book, Susanna Fu, Fresh Inspiration, New Approaches to Chinese Cuisine. Hey, Susanna, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much.
How did you first start cooking in a restaurant? I mean, how did you become a chef?
Totally by accident. It was 1979. My husband's family opened a second restaurant in downtown Philadelphia. So they asked us to help them running. And we thought we are running the front. and wasn't very successful. Then I saw the food coming out. I thought it was horrible too. So I started going back to the kitchen. Then I thought, if I'm cooking, I should cook the way I cook at home instead of guess what American likes. Because I grew up with all the fresh ingredient, fresh vegetable, and we shop every day, and everything is simple. So I thought I'd start in using just fresh, no cans, no already made sauce, and no MSG. And was a little bit of a revolution. We had a fight, argument with the family, but finally they agree what I'm doing.
And you, the thing that's so interesting about your food, it's Chinese, but you don't use a lot of Chinese ingredients. I mean, as you said, the canned water chestnuts or the bamboo shoots or that kind of thing.
No, because they have sort of a chemical taste to it. And if you never taste fresh water chestnut, maybe it's okay. But I taste the fresh water chestnut and I cannot use the canned ones. The bamboo shoots is horrible. If you taste the bamboo shoots, fresh bamboo shoots, in the spring, yeah, or in the fall when the frost get to the bamboo, they have such a sweet taste and crunch and a very different texture and flavors, just like artichoke. There's nothing like artichoke. And in Chinese, there's nothing like bamboo shoots.
So you started using the ingredients that you could get fresh and just had them stand in for what might be traditionally Chinese.
Right. The only ingredient that I think it's necessary is soy sauce. And at home, I use extra virgin olive oil. I use a lot. I like that. I use for saute, I use for salad, and I also use for marinade for fish and meat. I use balsamic vinegar because I grew up with Chinese black vinegar, and which is hard to get. And when you get them in this country, nowadays you can get some good ones, but used to be really not very good. So I use balsamic vinegar. And Chinese use Shaoxing wine, which is sort of like brownish wine, rice wine.
Yeah.
And I found it's very hard to get good Shaoxing wine, so I've been using brandy, whiskey.
So these are things we would have.
Yeah, then rice wine, I would use vodka, gin, vermouth, because they are neutral with very good flavors.
Can we talk about Chinese techniques? Because you, throughout the book, you do use all of these ingredients that many of us are used to. We can find them in supermarkets. But what you do with them is distinctly different from what, you know, we might be used to doing coming from Western cooking.
Right. You know, Chinese, we eat a lot of vegetables.
Right, yeah.
Also, maybe because we were poor and so the meat is sort of scarce. So there's a lot of Chinese techniques like quick stir fry. For instance, Brussels sprouts. Here, you like to cook them for 20, 30, maybe 40 minutes. Yeah. And for Chinese, I would just quickly with the garlic, olive oil, and just a quick stir fry. So you still have that beautiful color.
Yeah.
And you have a little crunchiness and put a little balsamic vinegar to the end. And if you like spicy, put a little bit of jalapeno pepper or dry hot pepper.
Yeah.
And also for other vegetables, like in the northern China, we have potato too. But we don't cook the potato, make a mash. We usually cook the potato crunchy. And so you julienne or cut into big pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And you soak into the ice water so you, the color won't turn. Then you just do a quick stir fry with garlic, with scallion. And sometimes we put cellophane noodles, sometimes other vegetables or a little bit of meat. And so the potato is crunchy, but it's cooked through.
It's a completely different way of experiencing a potato, too.
Right.
I'm thinking about Chinese technique with stews. You use a technique where you'll boil the meat or the chicken wings for a little while and then pull them out and then make a stew. Why do you do that step?
Because Western usually use oil and garlic and seal the meat.
You
so
brown
the meat
it.
Outside
yeah.
is... Yeah. Brown the meat. And the Chinese, we like clarify. What they usually do is to use boiling water and plunge in the meat and take away all this blood and all this scum. Then you dump this water. Then you start with a little bit of garlic, and then you put the meat. We don't, usually don't use water. And then you use a whole bottle of Shaoxing wine, you use a little bit of soy sauce, use black vinegar. Then you cover it tight and braise them. So by the end, when you the meat is finished, maybe sometime 1 hour, 2 hours, then the braising liquid is clear and then has a wonderful flavor. So I use the same technique for my braising, which is easy for me because I don't have to seal anymore. Also, I use brandy whiskey, and you know, instead of Shaoxing wine to cook this dish. But you have to use a really heavy braising pot that the lid has to be very tight to cover.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Susanna, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Chef and author Susanna Fu's book is Susanna Fu, Fresh Inspiration. Now, to get that recipe for Mandarin potato salad with cellophane noodles, go to the website, guys, splendidtable.org. So what does a computer guy from Maryland do when he's landed in Austin, Texas, up to his ears in the corporate thing? Well, David Ansel made the most logical next move. He quit his job and became a soup peddler. He delivered the goods on his bike, Old Yellow, sometimes with Alex the Wonder Dog, and now David has written a cookbook. Well, it's really more of a diary. It's about a year of delivering soup in a singular community. David Ansel is author of The Soup Peddler's Slow and Difficult Soups. Hey, David, welcome.
My pleasure to be here, Lynn. So thanks for a great introduction.
Well, did you consider this a lateral move in your career plan?
I think plan is generous. career generous also, but thank you. When I started the business, it was more of a project than a business. It's a business now, but it was really a project and ended up becoming kind of a statement. And it became a one of these weird and wonderful things about Austin that Austinites love to brag about.
When you say a statement, what kind of statement?
I guess it was a lot about being kind of a throwback to the milkman.
Oh, yeah,
And just being that smiling guy that comes up to your house and drops off the soup in this case. And that was a statement about people being connected to the people who make their food and also just being connected as a community. The other part of the statement was about the bicycle, and it was kind of about being silly, being childlike, being environmentalist, and just having fun with life.
You know, it sounds a little bit like a dream existence. You make soup.
It was.
The slow and difficult part of the title, where does the difficult come from?
Not really difficult. It was just, I was just trying to get people to give us a second look on the bookshelf, to be quite honest. There's a lot of quick and easy, and I wanted to filter out the audience a little bit. Anyone that looks at Slow and Difficult and doesn't give it a second look is not my crowd. And the folks that give it a second look have a good chance of picking it up off the bookshelf.
So how did you actually do the soup?
Well, I started the business in my home kitchen. I did a little rough calculation. I went down to the store and bought a big pot, 60-quart pot, and chopped vegetables for hours and hours. And, you know, it was very green. And I really didn't know how to make soup when I started this. Cut to 4 years later, I've got a 40-gallon steam-jacketed kettle and a 25-gallon tilt skillet. And I can write recipes for 25-gallon batches as, like, a poem. Okay, I know I need to, you know, verse, verse, chorus, verse. Got to have this rhyme scheme. You know, this is going to have this many pounds of beans. I'm sure we're going to, since we're offsetting that with some salt and this and that, I can write a recipe for a batch of soup from my head now. Yeah.
What was the first soup?
The first soup was a veggie gumbo, and it was, I shudder to think of how it tasted. But my early customers were very dedicated, very supportive, and had apparently really dull palates. So. Yeah, there's quite a learning curve to delivering, well, last year, 10,000 gallons of soup around Austin on bicycles.
You write about this community, and it sounds almost, again, like a dream world. Can you tell us what makes it special?
I can. Things that make Austin, and in particular my small part of Austin, special are that people value self-expression and they value individualism. This is not; these are not unique things, mm-hmm. but it's almost a battle cry. South Austin, secede. Or these are the bumper stickers. South Austin, we're all here because we're not all there. Or I'd rather be a fence post in South Austin than the king of Tennessee. You know, there's all kinds of bumper stickers about how proud we are to be from South Austin. And it sounds very trite, I know, to say that, well, what's the most special thing about your town? Well, mm-hmm. it's the people. It's trite, but it's true. You actually have to hide to not make friends. You actually have to to burrow into a hole, not to be subsumed into a community. It's really beautiful.
And they supported the peddler like crazy. But this book is about a soup season 4 years ago. So are you
That's correct.
Are you still peddling?
I peddle to and from work. I do the occasional emergency soup delivery by mm-hmm. bike. But mostly right now I'm kind of the president and principal soup maker of Soup Peddler Inc. And now, inevitably, we've gone to refrigerated trucks, which is not quite as charming as, you know, the original boy on his bike. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to do some really special things with the business to keep the story very rich.
Well, David Ansel, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Ansel is author of The Soup Peddler's Slow and Difficult Soups. Now, David left us with the recipe for his favorite grandmother soup. It's called Buchtopf, and the recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. It's back. We are playing Stump the Cook. Now, here's how the game works. You tell me five things in your refrigerator, and my job is to come up with something that you would really eat and something that our stump master deems acceptable. We have a guest celebrity stump master with us today, Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm going to be tough on you today.
You going to beat me up?
I don't know. We'll see how good you really are.
Okay.
We have Steve on the line. Where are you calling from, Steve?
From Minneapolis.
From Minneapolis. And here are the rules, real quick. Five ingredients from your fridge, nothing with mold on it. Lynn gets salt, pepper, oil, and water, and she's going to make a dish which I'm going to have to decide is acceptable. And then she can also ask for three additional items from your kitchen to put in with those five ingredients in your refrigerator.
And, Steve, we should make this public. I have no idea what's in your refrigerator, right?
That's absolutely true.
Okay, fire away, Steve. Five things.
Okay, boneless, skinless chicken breast.
Boneless skin chicken breast, okay.
Red and black beans.
Red and black beans. This is easy,
okay.
Steve.
I didn't want to do cream cheese. In the past, people did cream cheese.
We're not doing cream cheese, okay. Cappuccino yogurt was a favorite also.
Oh, my God. Yep. No, we're not doing that. Okay, carrots and celery.
Carrots and celery.
And black currant preserves.
Black, okay. All right, so I get salt, pepper, water, and some kind of fat, right? And then three ingredients you really have.
You have to make, what, 500 things from this?
No, easy. One dish.
This is simple.
Make something good.
Yeah, something really good, though, right? Yeah, because it can't just be like a stew or something. Okay, this is the deal. Oh, you know what we could do with this? This is really cool. Okay, do you have olive oil?
Yes.
Okay, great. This is what we want to do. And how about, do you have any chili or hot pepper or anything like that?
I mean, in the jars or fresh?
Well, either one.
Both. Little Mexican pepper is used for Chinese food. I have some of that.
Okay, that's good.
And I've got some chili powder. Yeah.
Well, let's do the little Mexican peppers.
Okay.
Are they very hot?
Yes.
All right, this is good. And then how about a little bit of vinegar or lemon juice?
Vinegar, no lemon juice.
All right, okay. This is what we're going to do. You're going to take a big skillet.
Okay.
And you are going to, that's three things, right? And I forgot to ask for onion.
You're already up there. Olive oil,
okay,
hot peppers, and vinegar.
And I have no garlic. Oh, life cannot go on.
We don't do garlic.
You don't do garlic?
My wife says it makes my breath stinky.
you use little hot peppers from Mexico, but no garlic.
Yes,
hey, what about the idea of having your wife eat the garlic and all will be well?
Yes,
you know, I don't think we have time for marriage counseling,
okay.
Right? All right. Okay, Steve, here's the deal. Big skillet, film it with olive oil,
mm-hmm.
And while it's heating up, you cut up cut across the grain on those chicken breasts, making them into thin fingers.
Okay.
And I want you to...
Wait. Is this chicken fingers?
No, no.
Is this where we're headed with this? Come on. I thought we said something good to eat here.
Well, you know,
take some breadcrumbs,
five ingredients,
fry them in the olive oil, and you're all set.
All right, enough. We're going to sprinkle the chicken fingers with salt and pepper and the hot chili. Okay.
Okay. Chilies are these little, you want to cut them up or whole?
You're going to crush them.
Crush them.
You're going to crush them. Yeah. Okay. Because they're dry,
right?
Right?
Yeah.
You're going to crush them. You're going to roll them in a little bit of that because otherwise your hair is going to stand on end. And you want salt and pepper with that. You want to coarsely chop up the celery and the carrot. You want the red and black beans drained. Okay. And what you're going to do is you are going to toss those chicken fingers into that hot pan. Toss them around until they're just barely firm. Mm-hmm. Pull them out.
Uh-huh.
All right. And then you're going to add the carrot and the celery.
Okay.
All right. And what you want to do with that is you want to stir fry those. You want to actually keep them crisp, but get them brown.
Okay.
And in the last minute, you're going to stir in a little bit of water, like a quarter of a cup of water, to get all the brown stuff from the bottom of the pan. And you're going to add about a tablespoon of the blackcurrant jam.
Okay.
Oh, wait a minute.
Hold it. Oh, I forgot one thing.
Oh, no.
When the water goes in, you're going to put in 3 tablespoons of the vinegar as well. So when you boil that all down, you'll get a real tart aftertaste there. A little bit of liquid left in the pan, and then you'll stir in the red currant jam. What I'm trying to do is make a sweet sour sauce.
This is sweet and sour Mexican chicken fingers.
Well, essentially, it's sweet and sour, sort of old Chinese chow mein chicken fingers, all right? But you want a sweet sour sauce.
That's better
way to describe it. Yeah, but you want a sweet sour sauce over that. That's the whole key here. And then what I want to do is, in the meantime, you've been heating up the beans separately, and you're going to do a little row of the red beans, and you're going to do a little row of the black beans, and you're going to spoon this over them with that sauce. So you get sweet, sour, luscious, tender chicken bits, crusty on the outside, and a shock of heat. So would you buy that?
Well, I definitely buy your description of it. The question is whether I really want to eat this or not. I think it's thumbs up for creativity, at least, right?
Hey!
It's a little complicated. You know?
I tell you what, Steve's got to make it. We're going to come over and you got to eat it. And then we'll give thumbs up and thumbs down.
I stand by
and
my
a whole portion,
too. Wins.
That's a brilliant idea.
Hey, Steve, thanks for playing.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll see how this works out.
All right, let us know. You have to let us know.
Thank you so much. A lot
you
of fun.
Are welcome.
Take
you
care,
are welcome.
Steve.
Our guest celeb stump master was Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. And now that we're done, now I know what I should have done. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, we did this one a couple of years back, but it came back to me recently while a bunch of us were talking about expressions we use all the time, but we never think where they came from. So the trivia question is, what's the origin of the expression to give someone the raspberry? And I've got a hint for you. It comes from London. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/Supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the origin of the expression to give someone the raspberry? Well, the answer is rhyming slang. Now, rhyming slang is a local code that London's East Enders, a.k.a. Cockneys, developed to keep outsiders from understanding what was going on. Now, the raspberry that I am talking about is a perfect example. You know that it's the rude sound imitating a bodily function, so why call it a raspberry? Well, it rhymes. The sound imitates the fart, which rhymes with raspberry tart. Now, food plays big in rhyming slang. A Cockney would say, come down the apples and I'll stand you to a pig so you can rabbit about your strife. Translation, come down the stairs, apples and pears, and I'll stand you to a beer, pig's ear, so that you can talk, rabbit and pork, about your wife, trouble and strife. And you thought Greek was tough. Well, it's time for your calls brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, tomatoes true to nature. Well, it's time to pick up that phone, and the number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Who has been waiting patiently? We have got Dan from Seattle on the line. Hey, Dan, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to talk about how to make a good latte on the stovetop.
Now, when you say latte, do you mean with the foamed milk or the steamed milk?
Actually, I actually do a cafe au lait, but my question is, how do I make a good espresso, actually, for the cafe au lait using one of those stovetop cafe espresso makers?
I'll tell you what I use, okay? And this is very old technology, but it makes, if the coffee's ground right and it's the right coffee,
right,
it makes a dynamite cup, and the Italians use it all the time at home. It's called the Mocha, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it looks like a figure eight. It has a tight waist and then a flared top and a flared bottom.
That's exactly what I use.
That's it. Oh, okay. All right. Now, are you having a problem with it? You're not getting good coffee out of it?
Well, here's the deal. I get mixed results. I've noticed that I have to be very careful when the end of the brewing time occurs, because if I don't take it off soon enough, I lose the crema and this very watery consistency comes up.
Yeah, and by the way, for everybody to understand, this coffee pot is a coffee pot where you have this figure eight configuration, and it screws together at the center, at the narrow waist. And what is in there is like a little cup that holds the coffee, and it has a long funnel that goes down into the bottom of the pot. You fill it up with water, you set that coffee basket in it, you screw the top on, and as you heat it, the coffee is sucked up through those grinds, through the grounds, and you get coffee at the top. Now, this is the thing. What Italians always tell me is, you don't get crema without the pressure of an espresso machine.
Okay.
So we give up the dream of crema from a mocha.
I don't want to give that dream up.
I know. It's a hard thing to do, but this is the real world.
But you got something that kind of resembles
crema.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you do. You just don't get the one that you can float the sugar packet on. You
right.
Know. Yeah, but, you know, it's like the Olympic crema. But the other thing is that you've got to use a medium grind coffee in these things. And I've realized I was using for a long time a real fine grind. And what I was getting was this kind of watery, yucky, you know, coffee. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even though the coffee itself was pretty darn good, you know, the quality of the coffee. So the deal is that you want a medium grind. Okay.
Okay.
And then you want dynamite coffee. And, you know, it should be the dark roast, the espresso roast.
Right.
And, you know, a great espresso is never bitter. It's really rich and round.
And complex, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There is, I have to tell you, you know, I have friends who are total coffee fanatics. And I had been hearing for a long time about a coffee bar in Rome called Saint Eustace, I think it is, like E-U-S-T-A-C-E. And someone just sent me, they're actually selling the coffee blend they use. I mean, people have talked about this place as making the best coffee in the world. And it's a little local, whatever. And someone, I have not tried it yet, but I know it's available online. And I think it's Gustiamo.com that has it. I'm not.
Gustiamo.com.
Gustiamo, which is G-U-S-T-I-A-M-O. Anyway, but it's Sand, S-A-N-T Eustace, I think it is. Anyway, that would be great. Lavazza would be great. But you want the grind for mocha. And it'll say, on an Italian container, it'll say mocha, M-O-K-A on the side.
M-O-K-A.
Yeah. Right. And that will tell you it's the right grind, or grind it yourself.
The last question I had about as far as the technique in making stovetop was the temperature, because I just crank it right up to high.
I do medium high, and when it starts to come up, I pull the heat down very slightly.
Oh.
Very slightly. And as soon as that coffee is up there, I pour it.
Okay. You know, there is some shame I have in calling you from Seattle wondering how to make the correct kind
hey,
of...
Hey, do know one thing. I mean, the coffee snob speaks, right?
Right.
You guys really have great coffee there, but boy, it is really hard to find a great cup of even mocha espresso anywhere in this country.
Right.
I appreciate your honesty.
Oh.
Hey,
well,
Dan.
I won't turn in my Seattle citizenship card.
Nah, they'll let you stay. Hey, Dan, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
You take care.
All right, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Who's up next? We've got Trish calling from Minneapolis. Trish, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
A couple of weeks ago, I tried a new pound cake recipe, and it was described as the best pound cake recipe in the world. And it sounded divine, you know, a cup of cream.
I love that. You know,
butter.
Now that we're not expecting much.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so I had very high hopes. I did notice something peculiar about the recipe. It said put the cake in a cold oven and then turn it on to 425. And I'm thinking, are you sure about this? Do you really want me to do this? And I'm thinking it's got to burn as the oven, you know, heats up quickly,
right,
especially to such a high temperature. But I said, okay, that's what you want me to do. I'll try anything once. So I put it in the oven and turned it on to 425, and minutes later, there is just smoke billowing out of the door of my oven, and, you know, up through the range burners and stuff.
Holy cow!
You know, I'm opening windows, and smoke alarms going off, and then as soon as it reached the 425 temperature, the oven, then the cake, you know, then the smoking stopped, but I still had to think, do I keep going? Do I take it out? What do I do? So I just thought, I'm going to let it sit.
Right. How did it taste?
Awesome. Now, it had a horribly charred top. Now, it was in a Bundt can, so that top ultimately would be the bottom. And I shaved it off, and it came off pretty easily.
Once you get the charcoal off, the cake
is fabulous. I'm picking with little tweezers, the tiny little flecks of char.
Right.
But, you know, once I had done that and flipped it over, it was the most moist, divine cake on the inside. And then the top, which would have been the bottom when it was cooking, was this thin, almost cookie-like crust around the cake. But I'm thinking there was no instructions in terms of, you know, cover the top or what to do.
Right, right. Well, you wouldn't want to, because then you'd steam it, and it would really throw
right.
off the rosin.
So is there something I could have done? And number two, I do bake a lot, and I have never come across an instruction. And I'm wondering if...
You're in good company.
Often, yeah.
You know, I haven't either.
Yeah, so what's that about? I don't know.
Oh, this sounds like one of those old recipes, you know, from the days when people would... did odd things.
It was supposed to have been Elvis Presley's
favorite
pound cake, yes.
I'll be darned. I'm just tempted to say that I wonder what would happen if you made the exact same recipe and you baked it at like 350 or 375 and then at the very end flipped on the broiler to get a little crust.
Right.
I mean,
It might work.
It might work because I'm thinking, you know, the billowing smoke is a bit of a pain.
It's a bit of a pain.
And the char. The other thing is, if it works and you don't mind spending the time or airing out the kitchen, what could be bad? I mean, if it's right. Fabulous pound cake.
It was very moist, and it stayed moist for days. I mean, day two and day three, the thing's getting better, not worse. And I've said that of, you know, soups and sauces,
right,
but I've never
right.
said that of a cake. So, you know.
I think this is a hoot, but you have two choices here. Try it at, you know, more standard temperature for a pound cake, 350, 375,
right.
and then grill the top to get the crust.
Okay.
Or keep doing it and just pick off all the char.
And just alert the fire department
yeah.
ahead of time.
Yeah.
Don't come to my, yeah.
Open all the windows, put on the fan, and suck it all out.
All right. Sounds good. I'll let you know how it turns out.
Just remember, this is the man with the peanut butter and the bacon and the banana sandwiches, which, by the way, are very good. But,
yes.
But, you know, I mean, we have to put things in context.
In perspective. I
yeah.
agree entirely. Thanks,
Trish,
for your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Pat calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Pat, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello, darling. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about coconut oil. My exercise coach has told me that this is the greatest food that's come along since sliced bread.
Uh-huh.
It's a miracle food. It just does all sorts of wonderful things for your body. It reduces, or I guess it increases your metabolism, promotes beautiful skin, healthy blood, triglycerides.
Makes your children brilliant.
and it's a baby food. Well, unfortunately, she eats it right out of the jar. She says it's so great. But I tried it, and the smell isn't as exciting, but because I love coconut.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I'm
coconut oil is
sure.
a different number, though. It just has a different quality to it. Yeah.
Right. And this is unprocessed. So
uh-huh.
I don't know how, and it comes from India.
Okay. Well, that would be a source because it's used a great deal there. And throughout, you know, Southeast Asia and into the whole Pacific area.
Right.
So what's the question?
Well, the question is it really as healthy as they say? Because I had heard previously that coconut oil was not one of the oils that we should be consuming.
Well, I'm not a nutritionist, but I've heard this before, and here's the deal, as far as I know. And by the way, one of the sources I go to whenever I'm puzzled about these kinds of things is Dr. Weil, W-E-I-L, and his website, because he has the nutritional background. He's an MD, he studied integrative medicine, and he has a strong nutritional background, and then he sources a lot of nutritional studies.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm remembering overall is that it is a saturated fat. That these claims that your trainer was talking about certainly are out there. I just don't know that there is enough testing to tell us that this is actually true and that these benefits outweigh the fact that this is a saturated fat that can have a very negative effect on your health.
Right.
And quite frankly, from where I sit, depending on the history of your family or whatever, until I would know, I wouldn't be eating a lot of it.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, the miracle quality of it, there's a lot of other things that have miraculous things about them that we know a little more about.
Yes.
Like olive oil. You know?
Yes. Right.
Makes your hair look like I can't tell you, and you smell wonderful. I mean, you smell like a green salad. What could be bad?
That's right.
Anyway, that's my take. But I'd take a look at Dr. Weil and see what he has to say. And, you know, there are other sites, obviously, as well.
I'll sure do that. Thank you so much.
You take care. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Did you know that you can divide all the food in the world into just three categories? And this is how humanity eats, according to Casper. It's my pet theory. Everything we put in our mouths is either raw, cooked, or fermented, also known as preserved. Well, we found a site that seems obsessed with the fermented and preserved. They have kits for just about everything you can think of and some things you can't. Jim Leverance is the owner of Leaners.com. Hey, Jim, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on.
We're glad to have you with us. And I want to know why this area of food, of all the different things you could have focused on?
I like beer.
Oh,
that's where it started.
That's how it started?
That's how it started, making beer.
And then you spread out into all these other areas. I mean, did the kits come first, or did the focus on solely fermented and preserved foods?
The solely fermented preserved food. That was the concept based on the home brewing experience and branching that out into wine and into mead, and then it just snowballed. It's a hobby gone mad.
Give us an idea of what's on the site.
We have everything that you need to make beer, bubblegum, wine, cheese, sausage, jerky, mead, and then the website is really based on information. All the recipes, all the instructions, everything you need to know is right there at your mouse.
Huh.
A click, and you can learn as much about it as you want to know before you decide if you really want to embark on one of these fermented hobbies.
You know, I would expect the wine, and you have vinegar and the cheese, but bubblegum? Bubblegum, Jim?
We are really a family-oriented operation. And in our retail store, so many of our customers bring the kids in, and they have a good time. We have root beer for them and so on. And we really needed something to offer the kids. And bubblegum just seemed like a natural activity. It has a lot in common with making bread.
Really?
And since bread is a fermented food, we make the giant leap to, yeah, bubblegum's included.
I mean, do you have to start out with a rubber plant or something?
No, it's the gum base, which is a polymer, not unlike cheese polymer.
Uh-huh.
And it there's a lot of kneading involved, like you would knead bread. So it's a great activity for the kids in the kitchen.
It's a great idea. And also, once it's in their mouths, they don't talk a lot.
That's right.
Hey, Jim, thank you for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You take care.
Thank you.
Jim Leverance is owner of Leaners.com, a website of fermented and preserved foods. And you can get more information on our website, SplendidTable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Bill Mather. Now, he said, "Beer makes you smarter. It made Bud wiser." And we can all groan in unison. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer, and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Recipes online at MuirGlen.com. Muir Glen Tomatoes, true to nature. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.